This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, a company backed by Google wants to build a smart city near Toronto. Our guest calls this kind of initiative surveillance capitalism. She and others are working to hold local government and businesses accountable. Two New York-based groups have just released a report outlining some of the problems with the state's parole board. Among these ongoing problems, there are at least two commissioners who need to be dismissed. And there are two important bills pending in the Senate. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Around the world, some countries are exploring the idea of and developing plans to implement so-called smart cities. Smart cities are urban areas that use electronic data to collect information, which is then used to manage financial assets and other municipal resources. The data is collected from citizens and electronic devices and is then processed and used to monitor and inform the management of traffic, hospitals, schools, law enforcement, water supplies, and many other community services, including libraries. The smart city concept uses information and communication technology to interact with the city's infrastructure and to monitor its development and evolution. Proponents claim that this will increase efficiency. Information and communication technology is used to increase the contact between local citizens and government, to reduce cost and enhance the quality and interactivity of urban spaces within cities. But critics claim it vests too much power in profit-minded corporations, and also that total connectivity may make smart cities a hacker's dream. In 2018, the Canadian government launched a Smart Cities Challenge, offering prizes of up to $50 million for towns and cities that will work to improve residents' lives through innovation, data, and connected technology. A few months earlier, in October 2017, the Google-affiliated company Sidewalk Labs announced plans to build a neighborhood from the internet up along Toronto's waterfront in a spot known as Quayside. The goal there is to create an advanced microgrid to power electric cars, bring down housing costs, improve recycling, and use data to improve public services. The project has support from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who declared it, quote, a testbed for new technologies. Here to talk today with us about smart cities is Bianca Wiley, an open government advocate with a background in technology and public engagement. Bianca leads work on public sector technology policy for Canada at GEN Network, and she's a founder of Tech Reset Canada. Bianca is kind enough to join us literally from the streets of Toronto as she takes a few moments out from a conference. Bianca, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Bianca, you have called the development of digital rights, quote, surveillance capitalism. Can you tell us your views on the idea generally of smart cities?
Certainly. Smart cities are not a new thing. I think that's the first important point to know, is that data and technology are already used pervasively in a lot of cities. But I think the second thing that is coming up as a really urgent issue now is that with more of this and with persistent surveillance through the Internet of Things really coming online now, we are seeing a gap in our policies and our laws to sort of manage this really extensive amount of data collection. And a lot of that data collection is potentially occurring in public space. And so I think those things coming together at this point in time makes smart cities something that, from a policy and legal perspective, I think really, really need attention so that we proactively define our rights to exist in public spaces and our digital rights. And that's, I mean, there's a lot in the umbrella of digital rights, but those are some of the critical issues that I see with this right now. And the final thing I'll say is that there seems to be this, you know, we're 20 years into this idea that technology happens to us and that this is the future and that these things are just, you know, due to happen. And I think socially it's really, really important that we begin to exert the human agency over technology and not let policies just be informed by, technology companies. And so I think those things together are a lot of the things I'm thinking about right now.
We have some specific questions for you about the sidewalks, labs, and how all of these policies will be made and instituted. But I had one more sort of overarching concern, and I wonder if you share it. With the Internet of Things coming into its own in the last 10 to 20 years, we've seen so many instances of hackers breaking into systems. And I wonder if you're as concerned as I am about the overall national security implications of a city that is essentially entirely smart, one could almost say laying down a welcome mat to hackers. Are those concerns going to be addressed as policies are beginning to be shaped around this particular city?
Great question. I share the concern. I don't have the security background, and so I think this is one of these areas with public education to understand what is already in place to protect the systems, as they stand today, and what is in place, in terms of discussions now moving forward as a lot of these things become more potentially centralized, maybe not. Those are things on the table, but definitely a concern and definitely an area where I think we really need to understand what the status quo is. And the reason that we also need to think about this is that there are trade-offs to consider, and that gets missed so frequently in discussions about technology in cities is, yes, this might all be wonderful, but at what cost? And I think the security piece of a trade-off discussion is critical and probably under-discussed. Whether or not that's going to be part of the regulatory and or policy ideas, that are coming out of the Sidewalk Toronto discussion, they should be. They definitely haven't been in the foreground.
Let's talk a little bit about the nitty-gritty. Will some of the technology underpinnings be rolled out and tested in pieces to ensure that they work? How much failure, in other words, will be acceptable as this new project unfurls?
The term pilot projects was visible from day one with this proposal and with this idea. So I think that concept is very much there to be trying things in little bits and pieces. However, there's also been a lot of discussion around technologies needing to be implemented at scale in order to realize their benefits. And so I think the intention is there is to test some things in a small scale, but I also know that, this is very classical, statistical, anything to do with data, oftentimes you need, in some cases, more of it or more space in order to really leverage some of the ideas. So it's an issue, but I definitely think that pilot project idea is there. This is where the political layer of this project is problematic. Particularly in Canada and in the province of Ontario, a big part of the economic development narrative is that projects like this will attract investment, create urban tech hubs, create jobs. And so there's a lot of pressure from a political perspective to declare a project like this a success. And whether or not those commitments will be interrogated enough is a whole other track. So I think that makes it challenging to ever say, well, no, this isn't working, we're not going to do it. The second part of that, which I think is unfortunate, is that today, when you're trying new things, when you're trying new ideas, it's known that you have to be able to fail. And that's part of doing sort of, testing anything. And so if that option doesn't stay on the table, I think this is completely counterproductive to this being an innovation project. I don't think it's been well defined, but there are a lot of risks here that would make it difficult for people to say, nah, this isn't working.
Bianca, this pilot project in the geographical area known as Quayside along Toronto's waterfront is one of the first in Canada. Is that correct?
Yes.
And tell our listeners briefly how you got interested in this.
When I heard about this project last fall in 2017, I had an immediate reaction to say, we're not ready from a regulatory policy law perspective. to be doing this project. And so that for me was my initial reaction and continues to be my biggest concern with this project, is that now we're in this position where it has been explicitly stated that we are going to be working on regulatory and policy ideas with a vendor.
The project is essentially to create one of the first so-called smart cities. And that means conceptualizing how everything is going to be internet connected and run, and will implicate a range of concerns from individual privacy, public safety, finance, and the like. Bianca, please give us an overview of what this Sidewalks Labs pilot project will look like.
Part of the problem with this project is that there hasn't been a lot of detail. There was a 200-page proposal submitted to Waterfront Toronto, which was what won Sidewalk Labs this opportunity. But details in terms of how this might actually play out in terms of the digital layer have been scant. So the idea here at a very high level is that this is a neighborhood built from the internet up, that data will be used to, you know, inform service delivery, potentially to help the neighborhood respond to environmental conditions, potentially have buildings being responsive to different seasons, how to optimize transportation. And then there's a layer around what sort of services that residents might be able to access, people that work in the area. And there's been a real lack of clarity around what this digital infrastructure might mean for someone who's visiting the neighborhood. Because one of the critical issues here is consent. If you're going to be in this neighborhood where there's pervasive data collection and use, what are the terms and conditions of existing in that public space? And those are some of the questions that haven't seen a lot of detail in terms of answers.
And maybe you might want to walk us through a few of those, but the one thing that I was thinking of is, will individuals be allowed to bring signal jammers or other devices onto their home if they don't want their information being collected? Are those some of the concerns that haven't been addressed yet?
Yeah, those questions have been asked, but they haven't been answered. It's a great question, and what's the agency in terms of that a person has in terms of participating in this neighborhood? I can give you a few more examples of the technologies that have sort of been used to describe this, like sidewalks where they're heated so that snow might melt for use in the winter, underground garbage robots, having modular paving tiles, which might be able to be responsive to use, so maybe to have more pedestrian use versus vehicle use. But if you can hear a theme in what I'm talking about, there's a lot of progressive-sounding urban planning fare. What has been under-discussed is what this data layer looks like and how people will be interacting with this environment where so much data is being collected and used.
And Bianca, something that immediately comes to mind as you're speaking is that I assume many, if not most, of the players are corporate entities, tech companies. Something we see in the United States is when there's privatization of services, from prisons to schools to any number of functions that used to be either state or municipally run. When the profit motive enters into it, we so often see services being poorly delivered, healthcare and the such, and individual rights being curtailed. Is that one of your concerns about how this might play out?
Absolutely. Because this starts to blur, as the very founding partnership of this project, as the line between the market and the state. Because in these cases, if you're saying, well, we're going to do all of this data collection in order to inform, you know, better urban planning, data collection and application to public policy has long been government fare, right? And so when you start to have the input to policy creation and decisions privatized, and then you're having a new interface between maybe a resident and government service delivery, There's a whole host of issues in there. So this is absolutely at the forefront of my concerns, because the second piece of this is not that, you know, privatization is inherently always a problem, and there's already a lot of it in cities. What it is here is that in a liberal democracy, we have to think about the collective and the way that these products that tend to be down to the individual's decision to do X or Y push us further from that sort of social contract where we say, hey, this is, these are things that we fund jointly and we deliver as a, you know, for a collective. And so shifting that narrative into this neighborhood will be tailored exactly to your needs, you start to lose track of whose needs might not be being met as well, because they're not getting the same service delivery, because they don't want to have some of the trade-offs. Some people might be fine with a ton of data collection, where others might say, you know what, I don't want to do that. So they shouldn't be receiving poor service delivery because they don't want to be, you know, part of a private data collection situation. So to me, you've honed in on a very, very important point and part of this discussion. Absolutely.
I noted that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has declared this a, quote, test bed for new technologies. That raises another concern. I know that we see software manufacturers rushing often to get their product to market. They don't do a thorough enough analysis of security vulnerabilities in those products. And we've heard of a number of really high-level penetrations from malicious actors or hackers as a result of that. If this is a testbed for new technologies, to me that signals that they may be filled with errors and they're using them on the residents to work them out. I assume that's one of the issues that will be addressed in the many public meetings that you are having.
Yeah, I think there are a few things about this testbed language that are problematic. One of them for sure is that, you know, if you're the first place for the testing, you know you're going to be part of some of the problems, right? But then you also have this idea that you can do something in Toronto and that that's your playground for testing, but what you're really looking at is a global marketplace. So how do you make sure that what's happening here is best for Toronto? Because to be frank, what Toronto residents want is what's best for Toronto, period. This is not a place to be having an R&D lab with residents. So then maybe, you know, you sink costs into this project because you're going to be able to profit from them elsewhere. That, frankly, as an urban planning situation, is a very bad framing. And the third thing is that all the hype around innovation and urban innovation is one thing. Who gets stuck with the tab for maintenance? And it is going to be the municipality. When you're putting some of these these new innovations in, and the hardware, if you see this is a long arc of history, the hardware or whatever the new thing may be bought, but what's the contract to keep it up and keep it maintained, and to your point, to keep it secure, and who's going to be shouldering those costs? Because this is infrastructure. And so all of those things are concerns. I think the last one, which touches on the idea of infrastructure, is also twofold, is that if these are going to be pieces of infrastructure, digital infrastructure, I have strongly argued that should be public infrastructure, because when you begin to entrench the tech corporations in the fundamental operations of a municipality, it is extremely difficult to get those pieces of infrastructure or products and services out. And so sometimes you have to think not about what's here today or what's here in a year. You have to think about what does that mean in 5, 10, 15 years, and what does that upkeep and what does that persistence of these decisions that are being made now mean for the city. So I think this is where we get into issues of sovereignty and get issues into control, because we have talked a lot about privacy, but there is a host of other stuff related to this idea of testing in a city here.
You know, Bianca, I have to say that when I read about this, I thought this is just a nightmare, because on a smaller level, we've seen the problems, and there are many, with so-called smart devices. TVs that record our conversations, for example, medical devices that can be hacked remotely. The list goes on and on. And we haven't worked out those fatal, in many cases, kinks. To me, when you talk about erecting an entire city from the ground up based on technology that is far from foolproof, it seems as though you're compounding those nightmares people get excited or businesses get excited about this, and maybe Trudeau is excited because he wants to be partnering with big tech companies. But it seems very short-sighted and really, to me, opening the door for one disaster after another.
Yeah, I'm nodding my head because we are in a time of unknowns. I think even the idea that you even have a handle on half the stuff, that having this much pervasive, thick data collection in a small location, what that could mean, I don't think we have that even defined properly yet. And so I think that's why, from a data collection and technology application perspective, data minimization is a critical discussion, because what we've seen in Toronto is a whole lot of discussion around mitigating, you know, like, well, you've got my data, how are you going to anonymize it, or how are you going to do this, rather than saying, why are you collecting this data at all? Because to me, the only secure and safe and anything data is the data that you don't have collected. After that, there is no security, for sure. It doesn't exist. So I think that needs to be part of our sort of social push, is starting to push back on this idea that initial collection is okay. And how do you minimize?
Exactly. And Bianca, just on a bigger question, the issue of trust. I know in the United States, many here do not trust Google, the other big social media or tech companies, because of their abominable record of protecting data. So I would say that anonymization doesn't necessarily mean anything, because data can still be sold in the aggregate and misused. Do you think trust is going to factor into the continued negotiations between your local residents, people like you, and these corporations that want to start building and running our cities?
Absolutely. But I think this is where we're at this really critical juncture of trust of government and trust of, you know, large corporations, where I don't think anybody's feeling great about any of the actors, frankly, based on the history. You know, like, I argue in a lot of cases that things should be state or city, you know, owned or managed. But there's a lot of surveillance experts who will immediately say, you know, they're just as bad as, as some of the large corporations. And I'm laughing because this is one of these things where this is a debate, but I think there's the opportunity for the government to reassert itself here and say, this is public space, this is operations of public services. Of the two actors at the table here, we would like to reestablish trust through the policies, laws, regulations that we set out that anybody has to adhere to. Whether it's a large, you know, large corporation, a small company, doesn't matter the actor. We need to remember that we have the power of laws. We can make certain things illegal if we don't want to do them. And I think this is where, for me, when I pick the side, I will be showing up to say I think the government has the opportunity to rebuild some of its trust and to reassert some of its role. However, I am not naive about the fact that the convenience that the technology companies have normalized for a lot of people makes them, particularly for people who are privileged, to say, no, this is a better user experience for me. This is a much easier app to use on my phone. I would much rather do this. I already have all these accounts. It's so much easier for me to just plug this stuff in there as well. It's a formidable counter to this conversation, but I think trust issues are problematic with all the actors, but I think the opportunity is there for government to reassert itself. But it really has to want to show up, and this is where we get back to the political narrative around this, where there's so much desire to be seen as innovative and doing things that support, you know, economic development. So this is where government's going to have to really show itself and show up. And I think if sitting government doesn't, opposition governments have an opportunity.
Well put, Bianca Wiley. I just want to let our listeners know that we're talking about smart cities, and it's appropriate that our guest is on the streets of Toronto to be with us, and we really appreciate it. In our few remaining minutes, Bianca, I wanted to ask you if you'd mind sharing, how did you get interested in technology? And if you could tell us a bit about your tech project, Tech Reset Canada.
Yes, certainly. Happy to. So I have a few pieces to my career. I worked for about 10 years in the technology sector. I worked at a startup. It was eventually purchased by Thomson Reuters, which is a much larger company. We worked with streaming, so video on the internet. So I did that work for about 10 years. For 5 years, I worked at a small firm where we did public consultation. So we were consulting and helping governments who needed to have conversations with communities. So we were independent, neutral facilitators who ran processes. So in this case, I had a lot of exposure to cities, urban planning, lots of different, you know, issues within cities, transportation, real estate development, and the like. And then 5 years ago, I started to learn about open data. And so this is where these things all triangulate, is that I started to learn about this idea of governments sharing their data to help inform public policy and to share more with the public to be engaged in any kind of democratic process. What we're trying to say as part of our work as Tech Reset Canada is to say, hey, you might not have shown up to city council before, but if the industry you're part of is challenging for people to get housing in Toronto, it's incumbent upon you to also be active on these files as well. So please, you know, show up and let's talk about technology, but let's also talk about public good and public policy. So this is where we're trying to make a space for people who work in tech and are related to tech to get politically active on a range of issues.
Well, Bianca, I think there's no better issue than a pilot smart city for you and Tech Reset Canada to do your good work. And we at Law and Disorder are immensely grateful and really appreciate your taking time out to join us today. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me and for making space for these conversations. Really, really appreciate that as well.
All right. Have a great day.
Will do. You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The person with the initials DB is a 40-year-old who has spent 21 years in prison. DB writes, "All people have in them a dream of being free again." And during this time, DB has actually had a total of 12 hearings before the Department of Corrections. 8 of those have been before New York State's parole board. Like DB, many prisoners have the same dream of being free. But for those in New York State, their chances are slim. An extensive report co-authored by RAP, Release Aging People in Prison, and the Parole Preparation Project explains why. The report is called The New York State Parole Board, Failures in Staffing and Performance, and it outlines the systemic and serious problems within the New York State Parole Board, focusing especially on the board's inability to perform while being significantly understaffed, and allowing continued malpractice of two board commissioners, Mark Coppola and W. William Smith. Joining us today to talk about the report and some of the problems are Dave George and Jose Saldana. Both have been on Law and Disorder before, and both are with RAP, or Release Aging Persons in Prison. Dave and Jose, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having us.
And thank you.
We'd like to open the show with a very short clip from one of the monthly meetings of the Parole Board. These are public meetings that they hold, dating back to September 2016. Let's have a listen.
If we were to be able to be consistent somehow and start them at 8:30, there's less of a chance that that whole thing was going to happen. We were a mess all day Wednesday. I mean, we didn't even know who was in the chair. They didn't know who was in the chair. We didn't know. It was basically just we were flying, you know, blind the whole day. So, and then when you throw an interpreter in the mix, we were a mess.
I can give you the breakdown.
The point, I do. I appreciate it.
That was a clip from a public parole board meeting in Albany, New York, held back in September 2016. Jose and Dave, your reactions to this clip, and how does it relate to your recent report?
So I think this clip is a really good example of the misconduct and the understaffing that occurs on the parole board and that is documented on our report. Yesterday, we, the Release Aging People in Prison campaign, in collaboration with the Parole Preparation Project, released a report that basically highlights what a lot of people have known for years and decades, and now the public has more access to, which is that the parole board is deeply understaffed, and that there are commissioners who remain on the board from a tough on crime era with the tough on crime perspective that consistently and frequently denies people based on the one thing that will never change and despite who they are today.
And the collateral damage of being understaffed is that incarcerated people are being denied due process of fair and just hearing, and families are continuing to be devastated by these long-term incarceration.
So that's sort of the context. The clip in particular that you just played was a clip from, as you said, a monthly parole board meeting, and it documents the conduct of one particular commissioner who's highlighted in the report, Mark Coppola. He has consistently engaged in conduct that we believe is unprofessional and doesn't give parole applicants a fair and adequate access to the opportunity for release and freedom. So in this clip, he's talking about how he and supposedly his colleagues were super rushed in a parole board interview and so overwhelmed, presumably by their high caseload or by just the general hysteria that often happens on the parole board with a short staff, that they didn't even know who was sitting in front of them. So somebody is pleading their case, a parole applicant, their literal freedom is on the line, and he says, "We were a mess. We didn't even know the person in front of us." And that, for us, is just an indication of how unqualified Mark Coppola is to sit on this parole board and why the governor should dismiss him in addition to taking other action that we document.
I have a basic question. Do these commissioners do anything else other than sit on this board? Do they have a full-time job? What are the reasons they can't read their caseloads?
It's a really good question. So I think the answer is two things. One is there are currently 12 parole board commissioners on the state parole board, and that means there are 7 vacancies. The board has capacity for 19 commissioners, but they didn't fill the governor and the legislature haven't filled the board to capacity since the Cuomo administration has been in power. So that means 12 commissioners interview, review the parole packets of, and determine the liberty and freedom of 12,000 parole applicants every year.
Wait, stop.
The parole board has the capacity to have 19 commissioners.
Oh, okay.
And they currently only have 12. So
I
there
see.
Are 7 vacancies, which again means 12 commissioners
right.
see the cases of 12,000 parole applicants every year.
So they have 1,000 each.
Exactly. And despite the fact that it's a full-time job, these commissioners are paid $106,000 a year to perform the duties on the parole board full-time. I don't think anybody has the capacity to adequately and fairly review the cases of people when they're that short-staffed. I will say that some of these commissioners we've heard do have other jobs, despite this being a full-time job, despite being public employees and appointments from the governor and the legislature. We've heard anecdotally that some of these commissioners have law firms on the side or participate in legal work outside of the parole board, are real estate agents, and also have really deep political ties that could arguably be their hobby, but is deeply connected to the parole board.
All right, let's take a step back. You have produced a hard-hitting report, and you've told us some of the horrible problems that exist, which we've discussed before in Law and Disorder. What else in your report are you calling for in terms of action items?
Well, we're calling for the parole board to stop actually making decisions based on the paradigm of perpetual punishment. I think the case of an elder who died 2 years ago illustrates how far the parole board has deviated from a humane sense of justice. John McKenzie appeared before his 10th parole board 2 years ago. He had over 40 years in. He was 70 years old. College degrees. He was the originator of a unique version of restorative justice as applied to an incarceration environment. He has influenced countless of incarcerated people, transformed their lives, and this was all before the parole board. And when he appeared before his 10th parole board, he was denied parole. So he decided to take his life. And At RAP, we don't call it suicide because we view him as a martyr. And he wrote a short poem. And in that poem, he ended it by saying, "Remember me as I have spent a lifetime remembering you." And I think that's a message to all his supporters, to humanity, to just remember that he existed. So at RAP, we honor him. We know that he gave up his life to expose this cruelty, this need to continue to punish and punish. I know because I've been in prison for 38 years. I was released 6 months ago. I was perpetually hit by the parole board. They could not get away from the crime. And this is inherited in this system of perpetual punishment. They have to look to justify their cruelty and their injustice. And I think that the whole thing behind our report is to get them back into the fold of dealing with what parole really means. And parole means, or doesn't mean, to retry the case. It doesn't mean to determine when sufficient punishment has been applied. The courts settle that. Their job is simply, or should simply be, to look at the man or woman that's before them and determine, with the use of evidence-based risk and assessment tools, which they have available, and make a sound, just, and fair decision based on that, and get away from making decisions based on gut feeling that the person before them will commit another crime.
Does the report call for the board members to change the factors on which they consider each candidate? For example, why is the crime even mentioned? Shouldn't it just be the individual's record in prison?
There are a lot of factors that the parole board is mandated to take into account when they're considering somebody's determination for release. So by law, one of those factors is the nature of the crime, somebody's criminal history. There are a few sort of static factors that they are mandated to look at. So if they weren't, they wouldn't be following the law. I think generally what we push for at RAP, that's certainly highlighted in this report, is the parole board, and this speaks to what Jose was mentioning about sort of what is the purpose of parole, what is the philosophy of parole. The parole board, while they may be able to consider and by law have to consider some of these static factors, their decisions should be guided by who a person is today and how they've changed over time. We think that's the philosophy and the purpose of parole, but unfortunately the practice isn't in line with the philosophy. I think it's also really important to mention, in the context of this tragic story that Jose just told, I mean, you had somebody who, in the late 70s, engaged in an awful act. He was convicted of killing a Nassau County police officer, something that all of us can understand to be a tragedy, right? But John McKenzie did everything he could to atone and restore for the harm that he caused. He was a staunch advocate for victims and survivors of crime. In fact, he won a $10,000 grant to run a restorative justice program in the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision. He brought together the family members of homicide victims with men in prison who were convicted of killing somebody. And he ran restorative justice circles and built community that promoted healing and real accountability. I mean, he was an incredible person. So the inhumanity of the denial speaks for itself and is one thing. You know, he was also a father, a grandfather, a friend, a beloved mentor. The other thing, though, that's really important to mention and that we speak to in this report is that one of the commissioners whose conduct we believe is so egregious that the governor should fire him, W. William Smith, he illegally denied John McKenzie parole twice. So it wasn't just that McKenzie got in front of Smith and Smith didn't sufficiently look at sort of his change and progress over time and just inhumanely denied him. These were illegal denials. So,
and what do you mean illegal denials?
So here's what I mean. At John McKenzie's ninth parole board, at this point he was, I think, 69 years old, had done 40 years in prison. Smith and his colleagues denied McKenzie exclusively based on the nature of the crime. John and his lawyer appealed that decision. The New York State courts said this decision is illegal. Smith could not and should not have denied you exclusively based on the nature of the crime. Went as far as saying something to the effect of, if parole isn't granted to this applicant, I don't know who it should be granted to, right? So she went so far as to say, not only does John deserve a new hearing, but this is so egregious, I'm holding the parole board in contempt of court. And as one of those court orders, Smith and his colleagues who sat on that previous illegal parole board were barred from the interview. So he was legally not permitted to be there. And he defied the contempt of court order. He sat on the 10th parole board anyway, despite what this judge said, sat in front of McKenzie. They acknowledged that he wasn't supposed to be there, that the judge said that he was barred by a contempt of court order, and he proceeded to deny McKenzie for the 10th time.
Why was that allowed to happen? Who is his oversight person?
It's a really good question. What the Senate Republicans in New York State have said in defending Smith when he was reappointed to the parole board in June of 2017 was that it's not up to Smith to create the schedule.
Right.
So the schedule was already made, apparently, according to them, and that Smith has to follow the schedule. That's his job. I think from our perspective, even if he doesn't make the schedule, he should have recused himself from that particular interview. He has all the power in the world to say, I'm going to sit on these series of parole board interviews that I'm mandated to sit on by the schedule, but the court is telling me it's illegal for me to sit on this particular panel. And he should have done that. And because he didn't, we believe the governor has cause to dismiss him.
Is there any legal recourse for holding our higher-ups accountable?
I think there is some legal recourse, the likes of which I certainly can't speak about as a non-lawyer and somebody who isn't legally connected to the case. I know that there was some pending legal action before John died, but I think after he died, basically that effort dried up, so to speak. It wasn't continued. And I think we can understand that given how much understandable pain his family and supporters are in. Maybe they don't want to keep fighting. They might be really tired, and I think that's really understandable.
How long does a typical interview before the parole commissioners last?
Roughly between 8 and 12 minutes. Doesn't really matter how long the person has been incarcerated. They make a decision in 8 to 12 minutes. And the reason why they do it so easily and so quickly is because they're already bent on hitting the person, denying the person. That paradigm of perpetual punishment, you don't need a whole lot of time to review the record if you already know you're going to deny parole.
The panels consist of two people?
Three.
But with the understaffing that we're seeing today, they often consist of two people. So it vacillates between two and three. Jose can speak to this better than I can. I think historically it's the standard has been three commissioners, which allows a majority rule vote for either denial or approval for parole. But with such understaffing and such a high caseload, we've seen, we believe, an increase in two-person panels, which means if the commissioners don't come to consensus, there's a split decision, one voting in favor of release, one voting in favor of denial, and that leads to a postponement. So the person is pushed back to the next month and has to sit in front of two new commissioners or one of the same commissioners and one new commissioner and plead their case for freedom again, detail the most intimate, difficult parts of their life and presumably the worst thing they've ever done. We believe that's exhausting and wildly unfair for parole applicants to, because of an understaffing issue and a lack of consensus on this state agency, have to go through that hurdle and fire again.
If I'm sitting in one of those meetings as a prisoner hoping to get parole, am I allowed to bring a lawyer with me?
No, the lawyers are not allowed at the hearing.
Are there witnesses to these proceedings?
The witnesses would be at recension hearings, or they can only provide the parole board with a victim impact statement.
Oh, so victim impact statements are allowed.
Yes.
Okay, for listeners who don't know what those are, victims of certain crimes are allowed in certain proceedings, courtrooms, hearings like this, to provide a written or an oral statement about how the crime impacted their lives. Some of us are adamantly opposed to their admission because they inject an element of emotion that, especially in jury trials, can really cloud the perspective taken away from the facts of the case. And as we know in this country, many laws are instituted as a result of a high profile or an emotional case. Same thing with court decisions. Juries may be swayed by this and ignore the actual facts or the directions of the judge. So I didn't know that impact statements were allowed in these.
Dealing with the impact statement is, personally, I don't have a problem with that because they do have a right. They have a right to feel sometimes they lost a loved one. They have a right to feel that way. And that doesn't go away very easily. The problem with that is that this system, it doesn't heal the victim. It forces them to relive the horrific crime that happened over and over. And it isolates the offender from the victim, and it creates an even larger barrier. If some of these victims or representatives of the victims will actually see the development of the incarcerated person, what he has done with his life for decades of incarceration, I think that's a big step toward healing. Because at least they can see a person who's changed now, who's actually has values that are similar to theirs. And I think that's a big step toward healing as opposed to just asking them to relive this horrific crime that happened for their satisfaction. They could use that to continue to punish.
Well, I'm curious. If an inmate reaches out to the families of a victim, and if by some incredible process, they are able between them to forge an understanding, mm-hmm. can that victim come and then say, I am in favor of parole? Does that ever happen?
That happens. That first, the Department of Correction does not encourage that. But when it does happen, and usually with a mediator, they ignore that statement then because it doesn't fit their agenda.
I think that's right. I think we saw that most recently in the case of Herman Bell. Herman Bell, for those who don't know, former member of the Black Panther Party, and was convicted more than 40 years ago of killing two New York City police officers. One of the officers' families was in favor of Mr. Bell's release. Another one of his families was opposed to his release. And with the agenda of the New York State Senate, or a lot of the New York State senators, the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, the police department here in New York, they completely ignored the family members who were in favor of Mr. Bell's release and only, you know, spoke to and talked about the understandable pain of those who were opposed to his release.
You talk about the agenda. Can you articulate that specifically?
Sure. I think from our perspective, there is, and I mean this literally, a pro-death agenda that is pushed by and encouraged by many New York State senators, the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, and people who are connected to police departments and unions throughout the state of New York, which says, if someone is convicted of killing a police officer or seriously, seriously harming a police officer, that person is irredeemable and should die in prison. So you have representatives of the state who are sworn in to make the law, to enforce the law, to carry out the law, to stand for the law, telling a state agency to defy the law. If the New York State Parole Board blanketedly denied people based on their class of crime, they would be acting illegally. So the irony here is immense as it relates to the agenda of people who want more death by incarceration, which is what so many people are calling for and what we are trying to combat, because one, we believe it's inhumane. We don't believe that anybody's irredeemable. We believe in people's capacity to change. We value redemption, mercy, and compassion. But two, just from legal grounds, it would be illegal for the parole board to do that.
What do you think is really key to helping push through change? Is it people calling, writing, sharing stories with the media, going up and visiting? Is it the Department of Corrections we need to be lobbying?
First, I want to just clarify something here, because the PBA, they launched a vicious and bullying campaign in trying to get the parole board to rescind the decision they made to let Herman Bell go. They were actually acting like they were representing the community by saying that the community doesn't want him. That's not a fact. I think CBS did a poll, and 70% of the people polled agree with the parole board's decision to let Herman Bell be released on parole. So their lobby, the PBA's lobby, is not our community.
And the PBA, for those who don't know, is the Police Benevolent Association.
Yes.
It's the union of law enforcement officers.
Right. It's the largest police union in the entire world.
Oh, in the entire world.
In the entire world.
I think our community wants, especially with the elders, and we advocate for the elders' release, our community wants to see these elders, not only the ones that are terminally ill, but the ones who have been mentors to other people for decades. They want to see them home. They want to see them involved in trying to solve some of these problems in the community, because they have a role to play in the community. They don't want to see them die in prison, needlessly. But so we have to actually get our communities to support bills that we are supporting. And one of these bills is the presumptive parole release bill. This bill requires that the parole board release the person on his first board, not his 10th, on his first board, unless there is a clearly demonstrated public risk factor. And in most cases, there isn't. And the other bill is an elder parole release bill. This bill requires the parole board to interview a person who is 55 years old and has served 15 years or more of his sentence. Because everyone agrees that as a person ages, he phases out of criminality. And I just want to mention this because it just shows, illustrates the parole board. Mark Coppola sat on a panel that denied me parole. This panel actually said, in my opinion, this is their words, in my opinion, a person like you, 60 years old, over 30 years in prison, he's the least likely to return, the least likely to commit another crime. And yet they turn around, deny me, and hit me with two more years. So this bill would allow these elders, and some of them remain in prison, and they are my mentors, would allow them to finally return to their families and play a role in community development.
What is the status of these two important bills?
Right now, they're pending in the Senate and in the Assembly, and we need to galvanize support for these bills.
Okay, so people need to get on those phones,
right,
and email and write letters and really stand up for what is right.
Exactly.
Right. So those bills, they clearly target the legislature. It's up to the State Assembly and the State Senate to move those bills forward and promote fairness and justice on the parole board. But our report specifically makes calls to the governor. The staffing on the parole board, the dismissal of these two particular parole board commissioners, William Smith and Mark Coppola. The governor has all the power in the world, we believe, to dismiss those new commissioners and to nominate new commissioners who have a belief and experience with rehabilitation and to ensure that the parole board is fully and adequately staffed. So really this report calls on the governor, calls on Governor Andrew Cuomo, as he's running for a third term,
mm-hmm,
to promote fairness and justice and not despair and death in his prison system. Since his office has taken power, more than 960 people have died in a New York State prison. The large majority of those folks were older, sick, elderly people who had been inside for decades, who had been denied parole over years. If he really wants to stand for peace, justice, safety, and fairness, he needs to ensure that that sort of death doesn't persist. And in order to do that, we believe a good start is fully staffing the parole board with the right people and dismissing these two commissioners. I think a lot of people bristle at this subject of parole and releasing people specifically who have been convicted of pretty violent or serious crimes. And the truth is that we in this country and in this state need to grapple with violence and our responses to it if we're serious about ending mass incarceration and promoting the values of safety and justice. The truth is the majority of people in New York State prisons and prisons across the country are convicted of a violent crime. And so if we're really serious about decarceration and real safety and accountability and justice, we need to be able to release people convicted of violence and think about alternative responses to violence that don't involve permanent punishment or death by incarceration.
Jose, Dave, best of luck with your report. And just remind us the website one more time.
Rapcampaign.com.
Rapcampaign.com. We'll be sure to link to that on Law and Disorder. Once again, always a pleasure to have you in the studio. Best of luck with this great report.
Thank you.
Thanks.
For our New York listeners, we wanted to let you know about an upcoming film on Thursday, August 23rd. It's Justice on Trial, the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. The film would be shown at the Males Documentary Cinema, 343 Malcolm X Boulevard, between 127 and 128th Streets in Harlem. The film was produced and directed by Johanna Fernandez and Kouros Ismaili. The film covers events leading up to the arrest of noted journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal in 1982. Justice on Trial, the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, will be screened at the Males Cinema in Harlem, August 23rd at 7 p.m. That's 343 Malcolm X Boulevard. Please don't miss it.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.